Welcome to episode 130 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. I have two items for us. The first is for those of you who like to do advanced planning. Next April will be the solar eclipse that will be visible through swaths of the southeastern half of the United States. And the reason I mention this is that it's going through areas that are not well populated. So if you want to be there, I understand that hotel rooms are already booking up fast. So plan ahead. The second is that since John died last year, Kate and I have been sharing the editorial and chief responsibilities for the Journal of Family Practice. And on July 1st, Anthony Vieira from Duke University is going to be taking over as the new editor-in-chief, and we wish him well.
Good guy. I've worked with Anthony before on a number of writing projects and editing projects, and he'll do a great job. So on this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want all of the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence and get one every day, plus a great primary care reference. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice, as our listeners should know by now, or the endorsement of any product. You can also get CME credit. Go to IAFP.com, click on their IAFP education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, we're going to talk about bempedoic acid for the prevention of heart disease, heart disease events, polypill, and cognitive decline in the elderly, post-exposure prophylaxis in persons at high risk for sexually transmitted infections, and asymptomatic heart disease and the subsequent acute myocardial infarction risk. Kate, what's this bempedoic acid?
I've actually decided not to talk about bempedoic acid. I'm only going to talk about solar eclipses. So I really enjoy them. I took my kids out of school to go see the last one, so I think I might do the same with this one. No, all right, fine. We'll talk about bempedoic acid, also known as Nexletol. This study looked at that for the primary and secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease in patients who could not or would not take statins. And as we know, that is more than a handful of patients. So bempedoic acid is a prodrug that gets converted to an active drug in the liver and reduces cholesterol synthesis by inhibiting ATP citrate lysase, an enzyme that most of us had happily forgotten immediately after taking our step one exams.
They had to do that when I was a student.
Not yet been around back in 1935. It has been shown to reduce LDL cholesterol levels by an absolute level of up to about a quarter in previous studies, but the question of patient-oriented outcomes was still uncertain. So that's what this study sought to answer. Patients with a previous cardiovascular event, about 9,700 of them, or who were at elevated risk of cardiovascular events, about 4,200 of them, were randomized to receive either bempedoic acid, 180 milligrams daily, or a matched placebo. All patients had to confirm that they self-declared as statin intolerant before randomization. But they were continued on other lipid-lowering drugs that they may have been taking, like ezetimibe, niacin, PCSK9 inhibitors. They did a 30-day run-in period prior to randomization, and each patient had to declare that they had at least an 80% adherence to and tolerance of this placebo during the run-in period. And run-in periods are a fascinating research tool that arguably they improve internal validity while reducing the external validity of a study. So they only randomized patients who adhered to and tolerated a medication regimen, like a 30-day placebo. But it can bias results in favor of the drug because patients who would drop out due to adverse placebo effects or poor adherence are never randomized. So you're more likely to learn about the true effects of the medication because adherence will be higher, but those results are less likely to reflect actual real-world conditions. So run-in periods are fascinating when you see them in a study. Anyways, the groups were balanced at baseline with a mean age of 35 years. About 48% were women. Mean LDL level was 139. 70% had had a previous MI and 46% had diabetes. 20% of those were uncontrolled. patients who did tolerate a very low dose of statin were allowed in the trial, and that was about 22% of each group. Again, that is a fairly real-world situation. About 11% were taking ezetimibe in each group. The primary outcome was a composite outcome of cardiovascular death, non-fatal stroke, non-fatal MI, or coronary revascularization. Another time we'll talk about the issues with composite outcomes, but this is a great example of why composite outcomes can sometimes be problematic. Patients were followed for a mean of 41 months. So this composite, again, ranging from cardiovascular death to a revascularization procedure, was slightly less likely in the bempedoic acid group, about 11.7% versus 13.3%, giving a number needed to treat of 62 over those 41 months. Again, this was primarily driven by reductions in fatal or non-fatal MI or in that revascularization. And it is important to note that there was no difference in cardiovascular mortality or in all-cause mortality. And people obviously very invested in a reduction in mortality and not dying. It is interesting also to note that the hazard ratio for that whole composite was a little bit better in the primary prevention patients than in the secondary prevention patients. And I kind of wonder if that's going to continue to be seen as they do more in different studies of this medication. Myalgias occurred in similar rates in both the treatment and the placebo groups, about 6.8% and 5.6%, so not in significant numbers. Premature discontinuation occurred in 30% in both groups, which is pretty high. 30% of people, again, in both groups discontinued. So bottom line, overall pretty small results from bempedoic acid. I don't think this is going to become the next like statin medication where it's widely prescribed. I think it's more likely to be like the next PCSK9 inhibitor where we see a few people on it, but not, again, widespread use. For those wondering, GoodRx says it costs about $400 a month. So again, very likely to see some barriers due to cost. Henry, any thoughts about bempedoic acid?
You know, the big question for me with this, so first of all, thank you. Your explanation about run-in periods, it was real clear, and I share a lot of those concerns about run-in periods. And occasionally, you have to look at them very carefully because sometimes the run-in period, not only does it include those who are adherent and who tolerate it, but also who have a positive effect. And so in those studies, the drug works in those in whom it works. So the bigger question for me is this medication and other non-statin agents, what is their role? So in the fire and forget, as opposed to treat to target, you have this issue where, well, it's clear that those patients who don't tolerate a statin, this would be nice to have some alternatives. The other question, though, is do these work as an add-on? And I think the jury is out on those kinds of studies. You point out that the differences in absolute event rates were tiny, less than 2%. And yet, if there's a 28% absolute reduction in LDL, I think you should have expected to see greater reductions in event rates. Gary, I think you know a lot more about this area because you've really covered lipids and quite a bit in our courses. So where am I wrong on this?
Well, you're not wrong. And I'm underwhelmed by all the points that Kate brought up. I do think the jury is out on this, but as we all know, statin intolerance, regardless of the cause, is a real problem, right? And every single study that I have seen suggested that when you have an N of one trial, when patients are blinded as to whether or not they're on a statin or not, and they report symptoms, there's really no difference. And so there certainly is something called a nocebo effect, which is the expectation of an adverse effect that seems to be at least prominently in the literature regarding statin intolerance. But it doesn't make it any less real for the patients, and I want to be clear about that, and I respect that as well. Before jumping to something like this, there are a whole host of other statin-related interventions that have been, at least in some people, shown to be effective, part of that is using longer acting statins such as rosuvastatin several times a week, trying different categories of statins from lipophilic to hydrophilic, you know, there's been some literature, although I don't think it's really robust, that, you know, you treat vitamin D deficiency, some patients might get improvement on that, although I know that literature is not great. So I'm not quite ready to raise the flag on bempedoic acid. It may have a role, exactly like you say, Henry, with regards to almost being like a PCSK9 inhibitor and some of those other less commonly used medications. But boy, I'm anxious to see more studies on this to see if indeed it is does have a legitimate niche for these patients.
Yeah, that was really strange. I agree with everything you guys have said, and the hazard ratios do overlap for the primary and secondary prevention, the confidence intervals. That may just be a fluky thing, or it may be real, you know, I don't know. But to me, the NNT is pretty similar to what you get with Zetia. Zetia costs, you know, $20 a month, not $400 a month. So I know where I would go first if I really needed to try something different or in place. But anyway, good to learn about bempedoic acid. Henry, you've got a quiz for us.
My quiz question is fairly straightforward. How long do ankle arthroplasties last? 1 year? 3 years? 5 years? 10 years? Stay tuned.
Okay, well, Henry, you're still up. It's your poem.
So my next poem asks, does a poly pill slow cognitive decline in at-risk older adults? This was published in January's issue of JAMA Neurology. It was called the International PolyCap Study 3, TIPS 3. I don't know what TIPS 1 and TIPS 2 did, but this is TIPS 3. It took place in 8 countries, and they weren't your usual suspect countries other than Canada. So this took place in the Philippines, India, Colombia, Bangladesh, Malaysia, Tunisia, Indonesia, and then Canada. They identified a group of adults who were at intermediate risk or worse based on the inter-heart risk score. They randomized these participants into 4 different groups, a poly pill plus aspirin, a poly pill plus placebo, placebo plus aspirin, or placebo plus placebo. The poly pill contained 40 milligrams of simvastatin, 100 of atenolol, 25 milligrams of hydrochlorothiazide, and 10 milligrams of ramipril. So reasonable doses of agents. The paper identifies the subgroup of those who were 65 and older at baseline. And by the way, there was another wing, a vitamin D wing to the study, but that's reported someplace else. So they had a 4-week run-in period where they took half doses of the medication. And so for the same things that Kate talked about earlier, if they were adherent and willing to continue, meaning that they tolerated the stuff, they were then randomized to either the full-dose poly pill or the placebo as before. So they had 5 years of follow-up. Guess what? After 5 years, blood pressure got better, lipids declined, cognitive function, no difference. And they tried to report some things about functional declines, and they said that that maybe there were some differences, but these score differences were not really clinically significant at all. So adverse events, the authors basically say, were low. They don't give you actual numbers. So even though this looks like something that works with regards to lowering blood pressure and lowering lipids, doesn't appear to have any effect on cognitive function. And in our courses, we had a section on dementia where we actually presented data from the HOPE-3 trial that looked at blood pressure control as a risk factor for cognitive impairment, but also showing the same thing, that paying attention to some of these risk factors didn't necessarily improve cognitive decline. Mark.
Yeah, not much to add to this one. I mean, pretty straightforward lack of results and, you know, yet another thing that doesn't prevent dementia.
It's a recurring theme. We identify a lot of risk factors, mm-hmm. but the question is, does intervening in them make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I guess theoretically, you know, you maybe the underlying basis for thinking this might help is that if you reduce cardiovascular damage, you might reduce the risk of multi-infarct dementia or some other kinds of dementia. I don't see where it would fit into the pathway for Alzheimer's to the extent that we understand it. Okay.
Yeah, I think, is this the same study that they've previously reported cardiovascular outcomes from?
I think so.
I think it is. So I wonder if this was a planned secondary outcome, or if this was just something that they happened to study, you know, as sort of a, by the way, as long as we have this data, because I feel like that would make a difference to how I interpret it. I agree with you. It's not, maybe not surprising. I do think polypills are really interesting as a concept. I'm sort of biased to like them for reasons that I can't completely describe. But I just, for whatever reason, think that they're potentially very, very interesting. But again, not maybe for this outcome. I would be curious to know whether
the next study, Henry, they've got to include the monoclonal antibodies also in
there,
the polypill.
There you go. Kate, all you have to do is sit next to a patient in the morning in the hospital who spent 10 minutes swallowing one pill at a time to recognize that, okay, the poly pill, because that's their breakfast meal, right?
So I think there's a nuance to these studies, and that is, you know, by the time somebody's 65, it's very possible the damage is done. And, you know, I think the concept is most of the dementing illnesses have a vascular component, right? And I think what we're hearing here is that if you intervene when people are older, over the age of 65, you're not seeing any benefit. I don't know that we could say the same thing with a quote-unquote poly pill. And again, these studies are hard to do. If you start people when they're younger, when they're basically before they've developed some of the end organ consequences of vascular disease. I like them too. I don't know that they're available in the US, are they, Kate? Can you go to GoodRx?
That doesn't bother me at all. They're not. Because, you know, I'm also fascinated by the FDA. So the combination of not available in the US plus like the workings of the FDA.
Well, you know, I think it's just the underlying idea of giving people medicine for a disease they don't have is part of the polypill, right? We don't know that all these people have hypertension and hyperlipidemia, and yet we're treating it. And so that's, I think, part of the conceptual framework that the FDA is going to go, nope, we don't do that in the US.
So. Again, that does not seem to bother them in so many other cases.
Yeah, well,
why would it bother them for these much less harmful, much less expensive medications?
True. Okay, I guess it's my turn. We're going to talk about post-exposure prophylaxis in men who have sex with men and transgender women who are at risk of HIV, and how do we reduce their risk of STI? So this was really interesting study, New England Journal of Medicine, Leutkemeyer, and it was volume 388, page 1296. And, a good study, glad it got a good platform in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a government-funded study, I believe. Yes, I'm sure it was post-exposure prophylaxis with doxycycline in men who have sex with men or transgender women who are either living with HIV or using pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. Does that reduce the risk of STIs? So they found 501 men who have sex with men and transgender women, mostly men who have sex with men, who were either using PrEP, which was about two-thirds of the population, or were living with HIV, which was about a third. The average age was 38 years. It was a moderately diverse group. This was a very high-risk group. They all had been given a diagnosis of an STI in the past year. 68% had been diagnosed with gonorrhea, 58% chlamydia, 20% syphilis, 43% two or more STIs in the past year. So very high-risk group. They were randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to either get doxycycline 200 milligrams as a single tablet or placebo, and they were instructed to take the medicine within 24 hours of a condomless sexual encounter and no more than 72 hours after that encounter. The groups were similar at baseline. The analysis was by intention to treat. Every 3 months, they got in touch with the participants and tested them for STIs. They also asked about any diagnoses or other clinical encounters where they were diagnosed with an STI. And after 9 months, the intervention groups had significantly lower likelihood of STI at a quarterly visit. This was true both for the PrEP group and for the living with HIV group. In both cases, about 11% in the intervention group had an infection reported, about 31% in the placebo group. So a 20% absolute reduction, number needed to treat of 5, which is a pretty dramatic reduction. This was consistent across all of the STIs. They did look at resistance patterns, and they did see some evidence of increased resistance to doxycycline in the treatment group in both the gonorrhea and Staph aureus cultures. So this is something that's a negative of this approach, is that it may lead to increased resistance. And so that has to be, I think, followed and studied a little further. Well-tolerated, 89% said taking the doxycycline was acceptable or very acceptable, and 86% reported always or often taking the doxycycline, so there was really good adherence. So bottom line, for this high-risk group of men who have sex with men and transgender women, taking a single dose of doxycycline, 200 milligrams, following condomless sexual intercourse, significantly reduced their risk of one of these STIs, an NT of 5. Gary?
Yeah, I think as I was sitting here listening to you talk, I was trying to think of what other, and I know there's a bunch, but two came off the top of my head. You know, we have a whole lot of other, you know, paradigms of post-exposure prophylaxis that just works, right? Lyme disease, you know, you get bit, you know, post-exposure prophylaxis seems to work. You know, you get, you know, exposed to influenza, you know, some of the anti-influenza drugs seem to work in terms of decreasing risk. So I just think this concept of post-exposure prophylaxis is a solid concept, and almost, and you know, I haven't done a deep dive on this, but it almost seems to me that there are many, many paradigms in which post-exposure prophylaxis just works because the biology of the exposure and the biology of the treatment match, number one. And number two, it's relatively straightforward, cheap, and safe. So, I mean, I'm not surprised by this. Yeah, good.
Kate?
Yeah, this seems like something that we should be able to sort of immediately implement into practice. You know, I prescribe a fair amount of PrEP in practice. And so this seems like something that when you have a patient where you're considering PrEP or you're even counseling about PrEP, just sort of immediately being able to offer, you know, post-exposure doxy as another treatment, even for patients who are thinking about PrEP but maybe aren't there yet. And certainly for patients who are either already on PrEP or who are when you're doing counseling for it, just to be able to roll this out. I agree with you about the doxy resistance being a potential thing to continue studying. But if the rate of infection is so much lower, I can actually see that sort of risk, benefit being almost balanced in the long run, that there may be an increased resistance, but you're going to have so many fewer infections that it actually turns out to be worthwhile anyways.
Yeah,
so,
at a population level. Henry?
Yeah, so for me, this is almost like a practice-confirming kind of study. You know, if you were to survey our listeners and say, hey, if you've got a patient who comes in and says, I have had unprotected sex with an unknown partner or with a high-risk partner, regardless of whether the HIV status, and like, how many would go ahead and maybe test for STIs, but also go ahead and prophylactically treat? And so there's a part of me that thinks this confirms what could be a very common sense approach to a high-risk circumstance.
Yeah, and I think the you know, this was an extremely high-risk group, 30% infection rate in the placebo group. But even if you had a lower risk, still an elevated but lower risk group, let's say 6%, the NNT is still about 30, which is still pretty good. And so even for a somewhat lower risk group, I think you still would see a substantial benefit. And so this was a good study. So glad we were able to share that with y'all. And Gary, you're up.
I am indeed. Patients with established ASCVD obviously are at higher risk of subsequent ASCVD events. And historically, these patients have been defined by a previous event. Have they had unstable angina, myocardial infarction, et cetera? One of the things I've run into personally, so this is what attracted me to this article, is that when we order imaging study for lots of reasons, and it's not uncommon to get vascular calcifications noted on imaging studies. And this is an incidental finding because commonly we order these for not vascular reasons. And the question that I've always had on these is, should we treat these patients, quote unquote, like somebody who has established ASCVD? Because you know, at least radiographically, they do have ASCVD, even though it hasn't become symptomatic. So this study doesn't directly address this question of incidentally discovered ASCVD, but kind of gets us a little closer. So this is a study published in, I believe it was in April in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It set out to define the characteristics of subclinical atherosclerosis, coronary atherosclerosis specifically, and its potential for identifying subsequent risk of myocardial infarction. This was in Denmark, 9,500 asymptomatic patients, average age of 60, who did not have clinical ASCVD. They underwent coronary computed tomography angiography, so CTA of their coronaries, and then followed for 3.5 years. Now, the important part of this is that the patient didn't know the results of their study, nor did their treating physicians, right? So nobody, they didn't act on this. So this was a natural history study of essentially what happened to these patients over this period of time. And indeed, only about 11% of this 9,500 patients were actually on statins. Their primary outcome was myocardial infarction at 3.5 years, and they had a secondary outcome of death and a myocardial infarction after 3.5 years. So when they actually did the study, about half roughly had no detectable coronary disease. And they were the base upon which the ones who did have detectable coronary disease were judged. 61% of the men and 36% of the women had some level of coronary disease. And when they looked at obstructive disease that they defined as greater than 50% stenosis, about 10% had obstructive disease. So that's kind of the demographics of this group. What happened at the end of 3.5 years? Interestingly, just south of 1% had a myocardial infarction, and just south of 3% had the secondary composite outcome, which is MI and death. Now, what they did then was looked at the relative risk of having one of these events in various categories of coronary disease. For example, in those, when compared to those without coronary disease, the relative risk for MI was 9, so 9 times higher risk in those with obstructive disease. Now, they also adjusted that for age, gender and known clinical risk factors and concomitant therapies. So it indeed was an independent predictable variable after 3.5 years. And then they looked at people who did not have obstructive disease but had extensive disease. And extensive disease was defined as greater than a third of the coronary tree had some evidence of disease. And indeed, the relative risk was roughly the same. It was about 8 or 9 or so. The interesting thing is that if they had neither non-obstructive disease and non-extensive disease, even though they had coronary disease, so you know, if you don't look at those two categories, their relative risk of having a subsequent event was pretty low. I don't want to say it was as close as it was to those without disease, but I couldn't do the relative risk calculation. I'm not smart enough to be able to do that. So anyways, long story short, it was pretty low. And it gets us closer to this idea that in asymptomatic people whom have radiographically identified, you know, atherosclerotic disease, it's not a benign condition and the like. Now, this is not an intervention study. They didn't say, okay, let's intervene. You know, they didn't compare screening versus not screening, but it does at least give us a little bit of an understanding of the natural history of asymptomatic coronary disease, at least in the Danish population.
Kate, I think you're up.
Yeah, I think I'm missing the point of the study, and I'm afraid that if I do understand the point of the study, then I'm not going to like it. So if they put a bunch of people who had no symptoms into the CT machine, which nobody recommends that you do, like even Right. The cardiologists don't recommend doing this. And then they found that if you had CAD, you were more likely to have clinical CAD.
Absolutely.
Is that the gist of it?
That's the
okay.
Gist.
So that does not seem earth shaking to me.
Compared to those without CAD.
And if you did not have CAD, you were less likely to have clinical CAD in the
yes.
ensuing 10 years. Again, it does not seem like a just mind-blowing outcome to me. But again, I think that it goes back to the point, like if you don't have symptoms, if you're not having chest pain, nobody recommends, if you're not, you know, if you don't have risk factors, nobody recommends that we put asymptomatic people into a coronary CT machine and look to see if they have asymptomatic disease, because we don't, like just
how are you
going to
pay for those coronary CT machines, Kate? You're going to be a terrible hospital administrator, I tell you. My God.
So, Kate, just to be clear,
I feel like that's
the machine that goes ping, you know? You got
to
turn on the machine that goes ping when the administrator walks into the...
You know, in the U.S., at least half of us die from heart disease, from some kind of, you know, coronary vascular disease. So the chances eventually that some of us, you know, that we're going to have something come out positive on our CT... you know, coronary angiography, it's going to be pretty high. I just,
I plan to die in a skydiving accident. Now we can skydive. So there's that.
We can arrange that, Mark.
Yeah.
So CTA has been used in symptomatic people. So this is in correct. The category of indication creep, right? And so, you know, if it works, if it's a good triage test for patients who are symptomatic, then the question becomes, is it a good quote unquote triage test for patients who are asymptomatic? And again, I'm not quite ready to act on this. But I do think it provides, at least me, the initial question I have is radiographically identified vascular disease a problem? And at least in this particular study, it appears to be.
How different is this from coronary, you know, calcium though? I mean, is it giving us the same kind of information?
It doesn't give us, CAC scores don't give us anything other than.
I know it doesn't give you the where the lesions are and how big the lesions are and all that. But it'd be interesting to know, is there some kind of correlation in these asymptomatic, mildly obstructive patients? You know, what's their calcium score? So I don't know. That'd be a cheaper, something we're kind of already.
We're already kind of doing for some patients, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Henry, last final comment.
Oh, gosh. Oy, 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 oy. Where to begin? There's so many things I don't like about this study. And the first one is that I think Kate hit on, if you've got coronary artery disease, guess what? You're going to have cardiovascular events. The thing about this, though, is that it was incredibly low. Even with their definition, this obstructive disease, a 50% threshold, where did that come from? If you're symptomatic, a cardiologist isn't going to do anything unless you've got a 90% or greater lesion. So where does this 50% come from as an obstructive lesion? So you start off with 9,500 individuals, and over the 3.5 years of follow-up, you've got 71 myocardial infarctions. That's a tiny number, even in a group of people who are supposedly at high risk. So in some ways, this is kind of reassuring. But this is a place where you can lie with statistics, that eightfold increase. That sounds really great. But, you know, if you're paying eight times more for that stick of gum, who cares, right? You go from a penny to 8 cents. Maybe it's up to a dime nowadays. You know, this is just one of those things that there's so many elements of this, whether it's definitional or operational or the lying with statistics, that just really sets my teeth on edge. Do you want to know how I really noticed. Feel?
Yeah. Well, let's tone it down a little bit and move onto the quiz, Henry. You got an answer for us.
So how long do arthroplasties last? 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years? So there was a recent registry study from the United Kingdom that linked this registry to their National Health Service databases, and they evaluated almost 5,600 ankle replacements over a 10-year period. As you might expect, the participants were older, an average of 68 years of age, and more than half were male. So it turns out that when they linked all of the data and they were able to see what happened subsequently, 99% of these ankles survived 1 year, 94% survived at 3 years, 90% at five, and 86% lasted at least 10 years. Of the ones that failed, two-thirds just underwent a subsequent revision, 30% of the ankles resulted in a fusion, and oh, ouch, 3% resulted in a below-knee amputation. That was quite surprising to me. So the correct answer is that all of the above are correct, kind of. The longer you're out, the more likely you are to have a failure.
Henry, that wasn't an option. That's a trick question.
It was a trick question, but basically it tells us that titanium can last quite a long time.
Yeah, hopefully, it sounds like UK British orthopedists are better than British dentists. And send all British dentists out there, send your hate mail to Henry at primarycareupdate.com. Just so you, anyway, no, got to make a British dentistry joke once in a while. Okay, so that was our podcast. Went a little long today. Hope you nevertheless enjoyed our conversation. I did. And if you want that IFP CME credit. Go to their website and sign up. Please tell your friends about our podcast. Tweet us, Instagram us, make a TikTok video about us, whatever it takes. We'll take it. We're not getting paid for this, folks. Hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.